This morning, I'm going to continue to talk about Shanti Deva's Guide to the Bodhisattva Path, Chapter 6 on Patience, How to Develop Patience. So this section is about our fear of being slandered and the kind of rationalizations that we make around it. And essentially saying that ends do not justify the means. So these are verse 52 to 63 in the text. And this particular section is kind of like a little dialogue. So I imagine Shantideva like going, back and forth with himself. So here, I thought what I'd do is just read the verses since it's this little dialogue that's going on. So the first one is, I put down here in my notes, this is kind of like the small self talking to our big mind. So this is this way in which we, those kind of internal dialogues or those ways in which we know. Remember the cartoons? They'd always show like the little guys, the devil on one shoulder and the little angel on the other shoulder. And it'd be like, do this, no, do that, don't do this, no, do that, right? Well, this is kind of like that. So the small self says, since disrespect, harsh speech, and unpleasant words do not cause any harm to my body. So, excuse me, this is the more mature part of ourselves. Since disrespect and harsh speech and unpleasant words do not cause any harm to my body, why, mind, do you become so angry? And then the less altruistic side of ourselves responds, because others will dislike me. And then the antidote to that is, but since it will not devour me, either in this life or in another life, why do I not want this dislike? And then this dialogue kind of muses to itself, it may be that I avoid it because it gets in the way of my material gain, but that will be lost in this life alone, whereas my evil will certainly persist. And then this voice says, well, surely material wealth will enable me to live, and then I should be able to consume evil and do good. So the response to this is, but if we're ruthless for the sake of gain, it's evil we will gather, dissipating merit. And then the kind of, lesser mind says, surely I should be angry with those who say unpleasant things that weaken other beings' confidence in me. So these are the kinds of things that we say to each other. And then the more mature mind says, in the same way, why am I not angry with people who say unpleasant things about others? If I can patiently accept this lack of confidence because it is related to someone else, then why am I not patient with unpleasant words about myself? Since they are the cause of the arousal of disturbing conceptions in my own mind. So here's the kind of logic and back and forth that Shantideva is presenting in this section. So the first one is, since disrespect, harsh speech, and unpleasant words do not cause any harm to my body, why, mind, do you become so angry? This is basically, remember the adage when you were a kid, sticks and stones can break my bones, but words will never hurt me. So this thing that we are getting angry about often has to do with a kind of ego attachment. This attachment to wanting people to say things about us that we perceive as being true. And don't we all want that? I mean, really. But this way in which we're so afraid that somebody's going to say something to about us that we don't like or we would interpret a different way. Now the things about these verses is, I always kind of give this caveat, is that, of course, you can think of ways in which the stakes would be higher, okay? But the practice is that when we find ourselves getting upset about something that somebody said or something like that, that we go to these practices to come up with a way to ease our suffering and ease our response to the point in which we cultivate equanimity, and then we're able to decide what it is that we want to do in response. So we might do something in response to somebody slandering us, But how are we going to do that? How are we going to come do this? You know, right now we have this whole thing going on around Kavanaugh's Supreme Court nomination. So Professor Ford, you know, she's receiving death threats. He's receiving death threats. I mean, clearly there's this way in which it's very interesting. The people who are engaging in death threats are once or twice or six times or 100 times removed from these people. And yet somehow they are personally taking on some kind of investment that is about their own sense of self, that they would feel so threatened by this that they would need to, you know, respond with a kind of violence and anger. So it's really important to look at how we get caught in this way of thinking about these kinds of problems. So Shanti Devi is saying, you know, when you find yourself having these very strong emotions like this, the first thing you might just say to yourself is, you know, these are words. Words do represent things, but they're words. They're not, somebody's not hitting me with a stick, you know, to de-escalate this in the way we think about it. So, okay, so that was the first line. Since disrespect, harsh speech, and unpleasant words do not cause any harm to my body, why, mind, do you become so angry? Why does this drive us nuts? You know? Because it does. Especially, it's like, you know, when you're younger and somebody says, this doesn't happen to me very often, but when I was younger, I can remember somebody said, well, you know what so-and-so said about you? Right? It's like, and what you need to say is, I don't want to hear it, but you don't. Right. What did they say about me? So then we say, well, because others will dislike me. So that seems to be, you know, we really don't like that. We really don't like the idea that somebody else dislikes me. This way in which, you know, it's going back to politics, it's amazing how much grief Jeff Sessions can take from Trump, right? Here's this guy who's like, every time he turns around, did you hear what the president just said about you? It's like, not only is it, it's like blazoned across the headlines of the New York Times, right? Jeff Sessions must have a certain level of equanimity at this point in responding to this kind of thing. So this way in which we just kind of mindlessly get caught up in this fear that someone will dislike us, this fear that who we think we are, who, how we want to be perceived, is going to be slandered in some way. That we have to defend our reputation. This is, you know, the practice of no-self. So the practice of no-self is not about persuading yourself that you have no-self. Or it's not about telling yourself that you have no personality, or that you don't have likes and dislikes, because let's face it, we all do, we are, and that's just fine. It's not a problem. The problem is when we get attached to our perception of self in this way that we want to control it, in this way that it drives us nuts, or we do things that are really violent and get engaged in these and create these conflicts because we're so attached to being perceived in a certain way, or we're so attached to an opinion that we have that reflects back on us our ideas of who we are as a self. And so we're going to fight about it. You know, are the 49ers better this year than they were last year? Now, maybe a lot of people in this room don't care, but I happen to be a 49ers fan. So when you're a sports fan, your team actually reflects you as a person. Isn't that absurd? But on the other hand, we get totally caught up in that. Giants are bad this year. Oh, no. You know? So we can see the absurdity of it when we're talking about sporting teams, unless, of course, you happen to be a really heavy-duty fan. But there's this way in which you see that it's kind of absurd. And so it's the same thing about these ways that we get caught about the nature of who we are and how people are perceiving us. So then the antidote to this is, but since it will not devour me, either in this life or in another life, why do I not want this dislike? You know, when people say things about us, And maybe, you know, even when we say things to ourselves about ourselves, right? Because this goes in this way too. It's like this way in which we say to ourselves, oh, I'm bad, I'm stupid, I'm this, I'm that, right? That we see through that and that we realize that that is not an accurate description of who we are. It's never an accurate description. Usually those kinds of dialogues, in a way, our vocabulary is interestingly simple when we talk that way to ourselves, which makes me think that maybe it's a holdover from some other voice from an earlier time in our lives, you know, because we don't come up with a complicated description to ourselves. We come up with something like, just, you're bad. You did this. You did that. Why didn't you do this better? That kind of dialogue with the self. So I think it's interesting. The translation is, but since it will not devour me, doesn't it feel like we get eaten up by this? That we're being devoured by this kind of a mindset, that it devours our equanimity, completely takes over our ability to look at the situation with a balanced mind. So this way, and he's saying, you know, really, this is not life-threatening. And yet, we think it's life-threatening. Some part of us feels like this self that we have is threatened in this very, very deep way, and that it's going to be annihilated if we don't respond somehow. So when we get those feelings going, it's really important to stop. It's really important to really look at that and have this kind of dialogue with ourselves and just say, really? Is it really, really this important? Can I find, go to someone, if you can't find or don't have in that particular situation a kind of inner confidence to say to yourself, either that's not about me or maybe it is and I need to look at that, go to a friend. Go to someone else who will say to you, you know, hey, it's all right. You're great. You know, you are beautiful. So that we look for those wholesome situations where we're supported, not where we're being torn down, so that we create this way that we're able to find this kind of stability for ourselves and also in relationship to other people. The next line is, it may be that I avoid it because it gets in the way of my material gain. And then the response to that is, that would be lost in this life alone, whereas my evil will certainly persist. So here we bring in the idea of rebirth, right? Is that the idea of rebirth is that we want to create and engage in wholesome interactions in every aspect of our lives. The end does not justify the means, which is what this is saying. This way in which it's okay for me to do something I know is wrong. It's okay for me to take advantage of a situation in which somebody is weaker than I am or whatever, that I take advantage of them because it's for a greater gain. From a Buddhist perspective, that logic is always wrong. From a Buddhist idea, there's always this way in which we can figure it out so that in each moment, the most important thing is how skillful can we be in each moment. So there's no sense that I can be unskillful in this moment because I'm trying to get over here somewhere, because each moment is where it's happening. Each moment is where we're making that decision to be skillful or not to be skillful. Each moment is the moment we're being asked to wake up. We're being asked to completely occupy this moment with this mind of equanimity as much as we possibly can. The other thing about this line is that my evil will certainly persist. This way in which when we respond with anger or any kind of emotions or anything that we do, we create habit responses. So if we respond with generosity, we create an habitual response of generosity. If we respond with hate, we create an habitual response for hate. We also know that if we respond with hate, we actually physically harm ourselves. That is bad for our body. If we respond with generosity, equanimity, it creates gratitude, it creates an ease within our mind and body. So there's this way in which we really need, again, we have to pay attention to the kinds of habits that we're creating, mental habits that we're creating that affect our whole life. So, you know, it can make us ill by cultivating hatred. So this is very important that we pay attention. We pay attention to this. And again, this paying attention is not beating ourselves up. It's not, you know, coming after ourselves because we've made a mistake or we've done something that's unskillful. It's not a way of going back and reviewing your life and beating yourself up for something that you did, you know, 2 weeks ago, 2 months ago, 5 years ago, 20 years ago. This is this way that we look and say, yeah, I could have done that better. So how am I going to do that better going forward? You know, how am I going to wake up to the fact that I'm caught in this moment? So that's what we're trying to do. It's not about beating ourselves into submission somehow, doing this practice. The next one is, surely material wealth will enable me to live, and then I shall be able to consume evil and do good. Again, this is this kind of rationalizing that we engage in. In this particular case, this guy is saying, or person is saying, woman or man, saying, you know, oh, it's okay that I do what I'm doing. I know what I'm doing is wrong. I know what I'm doing is unskillful, but I'm doing it for a greater good. So it's okay. It's okay that I engage in this kind of behavior because down the road, it's going to be the right thing. Down the road, in this particular case, down the road, I'm going to make so much money. Now, I may just, you know, destroy people's lives getting all this money, but when I get all that money, I'm going to do good. I'm going to be a, you know, philanthropist, and I'm going to go save everybody in Africa or whatever it is that you think you're doing. So from a Buddhist point of view, and I think in general, from an ethical point of view, that's not okay. It's not okay to do that. So that's an example that we can all say, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. But what do we do in our own lives? How do we rationalize our behavior in our own lives? Because that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about a kind of rationalization. So it doesn't matter, this particular example is not, you know, it's one that we can understand, but our rationalizations often are quite subtle. So this way in which we look at the subtlety of our persuasion to the self. Groups do this too. In a group, you will persuade yourself that it's okay to do something that you know, if you were an individual and thought about it, you know would probably not be the right course of action. But because it's in a group and everybody's rationalizing together, then you do things that are hurtful and unskillful. So that's, you know, the precepts are this way that we have a guide to go back to this. We go back to the precepts and we say, is this right speech? Is this right action? Is this helpful? Is this causing harm? You know? So we have these guidelines that we can always return to. And then the next line is, but if we're ruthless for the sake of gain, it's evil we will gather, dissipating merit. So again, this is a kind of Buddhist teaching, the notion that we are accumulating merit, particularly for the next rebirth. We're accumulating merit. And so, but we don't need to worry about the next rebirth. In Zen, we're worried about the next moment. So we can't put it off. You know, I can just imagine saying, well, let's see, if I do this many good things, I can create a certain amount of merit for my next rebirth. So it's okay if I do this thing over here. Even though I know it's not the right thing to do, it's okay because it got all this merit. In Zen, it's like it doesn't work that way. In Zen, it's like this moment, this moment, this moment, this moment. It actually doesn't work that way in the rebirth system either because you're just supposed to do the right thing as often as you can. That's our mandate, right? Our bodhisattva practice. Buddhist practice in general. So, gather evil and we dissipate merit. So then the small mind says, surely I should be angry with those who say unpleasant things that weaken other beings' confidence in me. I like this because this is how we are. It's like, okay, yeah, you just explained to me how this one thing over here is like not very workable, but wait, you know, but wait, I have something else here. But what about this thing? You know, what about that? So he goes, oh, but wait, wait. What about this other thing? Why shouldn't I be angry with those who say unpleasant things that weaken other beings' confidence in me, right? And then the antidote to that is, the logic to that is to say, in the same way, why am I not angry with people who say unpleasant things about others? And that's an interesting question. Why is it when somebody says something about us, you know, we don't like, we get all upset, but if they say it about somebody else, then it's like, well, you know, that's their problem. Now, sometimes we do get really upset when people say things about other people. And that's an interesting thing to look at, too. So this way in which we just so personalize things, you know, everything becomes about us. Like when we get really upset, like if somebody is a friend of ours, they're kind of part of us. And I'm not saying this to say to you, you should never get upset or you shouldn't defend your friends or something like that. But again, the issue around this is that how do I keep my stable mind? You know, if somebody says something about me, the response is not to punch them in the face, right? If somebody says something about me that I don't like, the response is not to lay in wait for my opportunity to come back at them and, you know, say something bad about them or mess up their lives in some way. You know, a coworker, okay, I can't wait, man, because a couple weeks, I'm gonna get something in there with the boss. So, you know, this way in which we realize that that's not okay and that it's actually harmful. If I can patiently accept this lack of confidence because it is related to someone else, then why am I not patient with unpleasant words about myself, since they are the cause of the arousal of disturbing conceptions in my own mind? So, again, this kind of goes back, if you remember we talked about, why do I get upset with the person who wields the stick if it's the stick that hits me? Remember that logic? Or why is it that, you know, if you're walking down the street and a tree branch falls on your head, do you get angry with the tree? This way of, why not get angry with the afflictive emotions that are causing my anger? Or why not get upset with myself for this attachment to self that's causing the anger? But instead, we want to blame something outside. Does that make sense? So they're saying, why don't I get upset with the emotions that I'm having and do something about that, as opposed to getting angry with the other person, right? So that's the logic here of what he's saying. Because we don't normally think about our own emotions as being something we might want to examine. Now, I think that's in a way a little simplistic, because I think we do examine our own emotions. I think we do, most of us are mature enough that we actually engage in that kind of introspection. But how do we engage in that introspection? Do we do it in a way that's wholesome and helpful? Do we do it in a way that de-escalates the situation? Are we willing to come back over and over and over again and do this practice to de-escalate something that's really upsetting us? You know, I'm sure we've all had that problem or whatever, where as soon as we feel like we've gotten a breath in there, it comes right back up. You know, there you are. It's like you think, okay, all right. And then 2 minutes later, bang, there it is again. It's like this little persistent thing that will not let you go. And it won't let you go because it feels like you've been slandered in some way that is really, really affecting your sense of self. So it's really hard to let go of it. And so you just have to keep coming back and coming back and coming back. That's that practice of working with no self. Last week, Jaku told a story, a parable, a koan, about Hakuin. So for those of you who weren't here last week, I think I have a different translation than you do. Because I went online, but it's basically the same thing. Okay, so here's the story as I found it online. The Zen master Hakuin was praised by his neighbors as one living a pure life. Okay, so he's a monk living in a temple, probably at the end of the village somewhere, or halfway up the side of a mountain. A beautiful Japanese girl whose parents owned a food store lived near him. Suddenly, without any warning, her parents discovered that she was pregnant. This made her parents very angry. She would not confess to who the man was. After much harassment, after a while, she named Hakuin, the monk, as the culprit. In great anger, the parents went to the master, Hakuin, and said, did you make my daughter pregnant? And he says, is that so? It probably wasn't a question. It was like, you made my daughter pregnant. And he said, is that so? After the child was born, the child was brought to Hakuin. And Hakuin, it says in this version, it says, by this time he had lost his reputation, which did not trouble him. But he took very good care of the child. So he took the child in, took the infant in, fed it, clothed it, took care of it. Says he obtained milk from his neighbors and everything else that he needed to take care of the child. A year later, the mother couldn't stand it anymore. She told her parents the truth. The real father of the child was a young man with a very noisy cell phone who lived near and worked in the fish market. The mother and father of the girl at once went to Hakuin and asked forgiveness, to apologize, and then to get the child back. And his response to that was, is that so? So, when Jaku was talking about this, is that so? When Jaku was talking about this last week, I had this idea. I thought, oh, this is interesting. And I think a way to interpret this and talk about this a little differently from what she did. One is not better than the other, just different ways to talk about this particular thing. So I thought, well, what if all the characters in the story were an aspect of the self? Okay. So who is the parental mind? And in this way, the parental mind, not the kind of mature mind with equanimity, but the mind that the parents had. What part of that, of us, is that kind of mind? The mind that wants to protect ourselves and protect what is ours, right? Because that's, parents tend to think of their kids as being belonging to them, that they're intimately in this relationship. Who's the girl, right? What is this part of ourselves that knows that we've done something that's unskillful or complicated or difficult or we're going to get in trouble for? And when we are confronted with that, we can't own up to it. We can't just say the truth. We feel we really need to hedge here. We can't just come out with whatever it is for whatever reason that not might be. And yet simultaneously at some point down the road, that mind said, okay, this is the truth. This is what actually happened. So that kind of mind. Who's the father of the child? Which person is that? What part of ourselves is that? Because you could interpret this, so you could kind of interpret this any way you want to, but you could interpret this. The father was the one who couldn't come forward. We don't even hear about him in the story, really. He could have come forward. He could have come up and said, okay, it's my child. I'm the one. But he didn't do that. So that part of ourselves that just doesn't want, I don't want to have anything to do with this. I'm like heading for the hills. I'm not going to, I just doesn't even exist for me. Who's the child? Right? That kind of innocent, naive part of ourselves, that part of ourselves that just basically, this part, there's no blame here. It's just kind of the causes and conditions of the circumstances. The sort of the product of this is what came about because of various things coming together at that moment. Who are the villagers? That's another thing. We don't hear about the villagers much. The villagers, I would suggest, are our culture. It's the society that we grow up in. It's the totality of our relationships, the kind of water, if you will, that we swim in, that is also going to make a difference on how we're going to respond to a particular problem that we have. And then Hakuin. Hakuin, of course, is our big mind. Hakuin is the mind of equanimity. Hakuin is the one that kind of calmly, sanely looks around and says, what would be the most helpful thing to do in this situation? Would it be to be defensive? Would it be to push back on the parents and say, no, 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 not me. I didn't do that. So he looked around and he thought to himself, must have thought to himself, well, what's the most helpful thing to do here? I think what the most helpful thing to do here is to keep this as neutral as possible. And so he said, is that so? Just, is that so? So this is this way of responding to not being defensive, not denying, not blaming. So Hakuin decided that was the best course of action. And I think Shaku said, this is the mind of things just as it is, the things just as they are. This is the mind of just this. This is the mind of completely immersed in this present moment of this thing needs to be done, I'm going to respond, and so give me the child. Without any kind of attachment to self, without any kind of need to change people's perception of who he might be, any need to defend himself, any concern about his reputation, but just to say what's needed in this situation and to respond. If we look at all these different kinds of minds when we're caught, that might be very helpful. If we acknowledge that we have a lot of different things going on in our minds, that we're not just one thing or the other. You know, we want to be one thing or the other. We all want to be Hakuin, right? We might not say, is that so? But we want to be Hakuin. We want to have that mind of equanimity because we're practicing. That's what we're doing. And yet, simultaneously, we've got all these other minds, you know, going on. We've got all these other chattering things happening in our minds. So we can't ignore those parts of ourselves. We can't say, get out of here, I don't want to talk to you. Right? So this way in which we have to sit down and acknowledge the fact that we've got a lot of conflicting stuff going on and kind of are working our way through the weeds of that and not just cutting it off. And again, Dogen says, you know, these are the 20 vines. This is how we enter into our problems. We don't cut our problems off. We actually enter into that thicket. We enter in and we say, what is it? What is it? What is this? With this mind of, is that so? Is that so that I have parental mind? Is that so that I've got the mind of the girl? Is that so that I have the mind of the father, you know, or the mind of the father of the child? This way in which it's okay. It's okay. And that we can apply the wisdom that we have. So, you know, I think I'll stop there and see what you all have to say about this.